Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton. And today, I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and curator and film historian Alicia Fletcher. Mainstream Hollywood has never really figured out what to do with animation. It's always had a bit of a lesser-than treatment, especially when it comes down to awards. Although animation now has its own category at the Oscars, it's always been a bit of, well, good for you, pat on the shoulder with honorary Oscars. Google the picture of Walt holding a big Oscar and seven little Oscars to acknowledge Snow White was something beyond special, but not something to compete with real movies. Well, that changed in 1991, when Disney's Beauty and the Beast was nominated for Best Picture alongside other family-favorite films like JFK and Silence of the Lambs. Alicia, Cam, let's get a bit into what it took for animated features to get their own Oscar category, and the movie that made them realize they needed to recognize the achievement of animated movies. Here's a quick hint. It involves chicken lip mechanics. Alicia, you love Chicken Run as much as I do.
I do. I love Chicken Run so much. I saw it in theaters, you know, at a youngish age. I think it really epitomizes what craftsmanship, and I know it's a gendered word, but craftspersonship can accomplish and what that can instill in a narrative. It's such a fun film. And that is really the film where I think it became quite clear that it's a 2000 film. We do talk about it on A Year in Film season two. And it's a film that did kind of, I think, the catalyst for the Academy Award category for Best Animated Feature.
Yeah.
And like you mentioned, Beauty and the Beast was nominated alongside 1991, alongside, you know, very accomplished films, taken for its own value up against, you know, non-animated films. That was the first time that had ever happened. But it would take almost a decade for there to be that category. And mm-hmm. I do think Chicken Run is you know, it was massively huge at the box office. I don't think people realize this is the first DreamWorks animated film, Chicken Run, how much money it brought in across the world. And it's a British, you know, these are British animators, and they're really taking a British style of animation and a British way of working and making it work in Hollywood. And we'll see that with one of our films as well, and one that maybe didn't work so well. But it is such a charming film. I do also think that Miyazaki is a big proponent or a big sure. reason why the Academy Awards got this category. Of course, Spirited Away would win in 2001. Absolute masterpiece.
It's a, like, I think Pixar too, because yeah. Toy Story won a special achievement in 1990. I think the other thing is, like, there was a lot of special achievements happening. There was Roger Rabbit and Toy Story in the, like, late 80s and 90s. True. So it's like, like the makeup thing, I think. The makeup one, people might not know, the makeup award only started in the 1980s, and it's because essentially there was all that practical makeup, and people were like, why is this not getting awards? Like the Elephant Man we talk about, I think, in a film fact. It didn't yeah. get anything, and you're like, what?
Yeah, and those special achievements.
And yet we don't have stunt person ones. Like, yeah. I'm still just mind-boggled by that. But I think what's so amazing for me about Chicken Run, and I think the reason why they kind of went, okay, we have to keep doing this, or we have to start recognizing these features. They, of course, were already recognizing shorts. We'll talk about mm-hmm. how Aardman Entertainment had, you know, already won a ton of Oscars for basically everything they'd done. Is that when you look at Chicken Run, you can't look at that and not go, this is something incredibly special and that is on par with any sort of technological mm-hmm. achievement that's ever been achieved.
Yeah.
So when you look at that movie, what's so incredible to me is all of the background gags that are happening that have to happen. Like, you can't just go back and go, hey, Owen, can you do it? Try it this time, this take. You have to know exactly what's happening at every moment because it's so specific and so precise. And that movie is so detailed with all the precision. It's
incredible. Like you have one shot, and if you mess it up, it's over. And what's incredible at stop motion is most of these films take multiple years to produce. And a lot of them are pitch perfect. Like they don't screw up anything. And it's just this level of meticulousness and craftspersonship that I don't think exists in a lot of other forms. I mean, animation in general, yes, but specifically stop motion animation. I have such a soft spot for stop motion. I will watch anything that's stop motion, pretty much any short. Criterion Channel right now, when they do the Brothers Quay. I will watch every single one, despite how nightmarish they are. Like, it is just for me. I think a mode that kind of harkens back to Méliès and the beginning of cinema and why cinema is magical, what it does that no other medium can, if that makes sense.
It's transportative. What, very well said. Thank you, Alicia.
And if I can briefly be the dark business person, I think the other thing to note is that Chicken Run was by DreamWorks, which is a Katzenberg thing. Yeah. Katzenberg, it's worth saying, was one of the people nominated, I believe, for the Beauty and the Beast Oscar.
Yes.
So I think he was gunning for showing, and what the Academy said, part of the reason why they started this Oscar category was that there was a diversity of companies now producing, whereas it would have just been Disney before. But I think a large part of that is probably Jeffrey Katzenberg either giving people a lot of money or making a big stink until his precious Shrek won the first animated
Which,
Oscar.
Also, if you look for the first few of them, it isn't Disney dominating them, right? It's Miyazaki, it's DreamWorks, it's Pixar until Pixar becomes Disney.
Non-Disney Pixar,
Yeah,
it's pretty impressive.
Happy Feet. Everyone forgets George Miller's lone Oscar for Happy Feet.
Oh my God, I had forgotten that. I love when we talk about George Miller, and it's always like whether it's Babe or Babe Pig in the City, just the craziest films that he's directed. Witches of Eastwick, baffling.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's get into our first movie, because as awesome as Chicken Run is, it wasn't Aardman Entertainment's first kick at the Oscar can. Their previous shorts containing their signature characters, Wallace and Gromit, had either been nominated for or won an Oscar every year they were released. It then only makes sense that the first feature film with the characters would beat out Disney's Chicken Little, our next movie, The Corpse Bride, and Miyazaki's own Howl's Moving Castle. They're favorites of the Academy, and I have to admit, they are favorites of mine, mostly because I see so much of myself in Wallace. Alicia, do you have the same warm fuzzies as I do for the Were-Rabbit? I love this movie.
Yes, I mean, so much so. And it was such a pleasure to watch this again after a few years. And I know firsthand from my best friend's three-year-old that this is a film that still really resonates with the little ones. I think it's just evergreen that way. I will say it's actually quite scary for a three-year-old. And this was she took him to an outdoor park screening of this during COVID. And so the kids could kind of like walk around and stand up. And I know that she said, like, I know what parts in watching this, like, it is the reveal of the rabbit, although he's incredible, the were-rabbit is incredibly cute. It's done in true Hammer horror, Universal monsters. Like, they're able to mimic horror films so, so well. I love that Aardman referred to this as the first vegetarian horror film. That made me laugh so much. And I think if I were a child watching this, I would be so pleased and so so mesmerized. But as an adult with a childlike mind, which is how I sometimes think of myself, I am having so much fun with how it's engaging with the history of horror, how it's engaging with canonical horror films through puns. It's just wondrous. And this is, of course, Wallace and Gromit's first feature-length film. They had done a lot of shorts for which they had been nominated and won Oscars. And it's just such a bold statement on stop-motion animation that this is what they produced. Because it really is, I think, when you look in this, I don't know if it is 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, but I think it's like 99%. This is just such a critical darling. It pleases every demographic, I feel like. And I know it's interesting because it's very British. And I do believe they did tone down some of the Britishisms and some of the very thick accents a little bit for American audiences. And yet it still retains you know, references to Marmite and things that I kind of only vaguely know about.
Now, Cam, I have to tell you that your mother almost killed my mother with this movie. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
What?
But my mother got surgery.
They're always almost killing each other, you know.
That is true. Your mother gave this to my mother when she was recovering from surgery in a place where it would be very uncomfortable and possibly dangerous to laugh. And she gave her this movie. And she had to go back to her doctor because some stitches were pulled.
Sure. Oh, my God. That's a great history.
So well done.
Nick Park That's would love that, is. I'm sure.
I'm sure. It's that good. Okay, I think this movie is especially interesting because it is stop motion. However, this is where they're starting to kind of put a little bit of CGI in it, just to smooth effects. The bunnies in the bunny vac are all floaty, so you couldn't really do that in stop motion without doing a bunch of extra editing. And so this is also a period now where when critics are looking at this, because we're in 2005, we're right in the midst of the everything is blurry CGI and Transformers are fighting each other and, you know, the Kraken has been released. And people are just like, it's so nice just to get back to watching real things do things. Yeah. That tactileness is the word they always use.
Tactileness, yeah, that is the appeal. That's why I still am drawn to stop motion. It's tactile, it's textural, it's...
You can see the thumbprints, like when they zoom in.
And this
in,
is where they're like, we're probably going to compare the two films where one desperately didn't want any thumbprints and one is like, we love the thumbprint. Like, Aardman loves thumbprints so much that it, Flushed Away is not a good movie, but their first CGI movie, Flushed Away, they actually digitally add thumbprints to those characters because they just love the tactile feeling too much. And they're like, the Aardman look is... It's textural.
It's plasticine. I always have to, I mean, it's very different than the film we're going to talk about with The Corpse Bride and the materials that they used. But I think everyone, no matter what age you are, can relate to the materials of this film because you've all played with plasticine. You've all molded something, a little person, and put your thumb in the eye sockets to mold a face. And so when you see that up on screen, I don't know, it just sort of makes it feel like anything is possible. Like, these are obviously expertly molded figures, but it feels like you could make these, that you could do it yourself at home. And I think that's really appealing.
Yeah. I love with all the interviews of Nick Park and every single one, he brought along little models of Wallace and Gromit to sit beside him. He's like, they're representing themselves.
Yeah, when I was at TIFF, for TIFF Kids one year, I want to say 2013, there was a full Aardman retrospective and... it was the year that Pirates was coming out, which I really like. I think it's really fun. And so I got to, you know, sit in the audience for a lot of conversations with Nick Park, and he brought all the figures traveled with him. It was pretty soon after the fire. I can't remember.
Yeah.
But he was such a delight. It was such a crowd pleaser as an event because kids were definitely in there listening to these very, you know, meticulous conversations about the mechanics of puppetry and figures, but then also like just silliness, pure silliness, you know, talking about the old Pee Wee Herman shorts and things like that and with Penny. And it was just so delightful.
Yeah, it's very interesting. There, I heard somebody talking about stop motion animation. I was listening to a few things and everybody points out that obviously these guys are... Anyone who's a stop motion animator is a meticulous weirdo. And it's like, what kind of weirdo do you become? And somebody like, to not speak out of school, I think Henry Selick is very famously a very prickly weirdo, a very controlling. You know, he's a guy who made 70% of a movie for Disney and they were like, not worth it. take your movie and leave, sir. Whereas I think Nick Park and I think Will Vinton, who is no longer with us, were both guys who found a way to take that weirdness and turn it into like a Walt Disney-ish kindness, you know, like that their outward thing is just being charming and cute and good for children and not being, because obviously this is an artistry that is insane. It takes so much of your life. It takes so much of your care. And it's fair enough if you become super defensive of it and weird.
It's also going to give you arthritis. Yeah. There's no way people don't have carpal tunnel, arthritis, probably a broken back from hunching over.
Yes, true. You probably go blind.
It's so physical. Yeah. It's so physical.
Yeah.
For me, though, I think the thing that just amazes me is not only are they making these characters that are plasticine come to life, like all animation is magic in that way, the amount of camera angles in this movie, this is an action-packed movie. Yeah. And I don't think we really gave much of a plot summary. So, Alicia, do you want to just do a quick plot summary so that I can get into the mayhem?
Yeah. So we have Wallace, who is, you know, he's really into cheese. It's I relate to him on that level. There is a cheese obsession that is problematic, and his long-suffering best friend slash caregiver in some ways, Gromit. Gromit is an entirely silent character. I think he has a mouth, but it's mostly he expresses himself through his eyebrows, which is incredibly effective. Gromit has graduated from Dogwarts Academy. He's very educated. I noticed that in this film. I've never noticed it before. He has a little,
these puns, oh
my
God,
little diploma on the wall. And he's the smart guy. He's the smart guy. Wallace is loving and good-natured and good-hearted, but not the brightest. And they have their own pest control company, humane pest control company called Antipesto.
Which is terrible. Wonderful.
Which is a joke I wouldn't have gotten at 5 years old at all. I don't know what most children mold.
Oh, I mean most of these puns. I know that British kids are fed puns at an early age, but most of these puns are just for the adults, I think.
Yeah. Glorious. I mean, I love on his, you know, bookshelf that we get to see, has books like The Hunt for Red Leicester, Brighton Roquefort, How Green Was My Cheese, Brie Encounter, Swiss Cheese Family Robinson, East of Eden, God, Graded Expectations, Fromage to Eternity, and Waiting for Gouda.
Like, I'm so delighted right
now. I could never have gotten that when I was little. And so they are, you know, in the business of clearing rabbits. And this is really important at this juncture because there's going to be a giant vegetable growing contest in the town. And so, you know, giant zucchinis, giant pumpkins, carrots, and the bunnies are posing a problem. So they've invented this thing called the bunny vacuum, and then also this other invention which sort of can deprogram rabbits by putting this headpiece on them and think about like kind of like hypnotherapy for stopping smoking. He's deprogramming the rabbits to then not want to eat vegetables, to have an aversion. Something goes wrong, and in a fly situation, like Cronenberg's The Fly, Wallace and the rabbit's brains get scrambled. So there's a little bit of Wallace in this rabbit named Hutch and a little bit of the bunny in Wallace, meaning that Wallace starts turning into a were-rabbit. So I think all viewers kind of figure it out, maybe not kids, but there's this were-rabbit that's eating everyone's vegetables. It's only striking at night with full moon. And Wallace and Gromit think it's, you know, this being, and Gromit realizes very quickly it's actually Wallace that he's transforming at night and eating. And, you know, he's kind of fallen in love with this Totty, Lady Tottingham, who is this, like, aristocratic vegetable lover who also loves bunnies. And so he's trying to, like, deal with her situation. She's voiced by Helena Bonham Carter, and it's great voice acting. I loved her so much. And, you know, it just goes from there. There's a lot of references to Frankenstein, a lot of references to, like, the Lon Chaney Jr. version of The Wolfman. It is just an utter delight from the first frame to the last. And, you know, a lot of references to animation history. I noticed this time watching it that he's listening to the song Bright Eyes from Watership Down on the radio. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about Watership Down in our first season on the podcast from 1978. And I just, those little moments are so loving. It's chock full of puns. There's too many puns to even, I know I read off every book, but then there's all these puns with horror films. It's, it is amazing. It is just, I love this film. I could watch this film once a week and never get bored.
There's always something new to see, and there's like some of the one-liners that just pop out of the background. Like there's one when the townsfolk, the angry mob, are lamenting their issues, and one of them says, "This is worse than 1972 when there were slugs the size of pigs." Right. And for some reason, that just made me laugh so hard.
Yeah, it's it makes sense. I mean, we've had subsequent feature films with Wallace and Gromit. I don't think any have achieved the greatness that this one is, although they've come close. But this is just so wondrous, and it's quite short. I think it's in the 70-minute range. And yet it just feels like such an action film. There are real scares. I mean, the were-rabbit, once he's revealed, is so cute. He's got Wallace's little bow tie on. That's it. And he's just very lurking and very cute. But like everything around that, like the lighting, like you were mentioning, the camera angles, Becky and Cam, but like the lighting, the sound effects, like it just feels like they must have watched so much Universal horror from the 30s and Christopher Lee Hammer films and just written down, okay, we're going to steal this. We're going to reference this film. And no one, I mean, there's probably people out there that get every single reference, but it's not meant to be that. It's just meant to exist in this world so lovingly.
I think he just loves, I mean, it's the same as like the League of Gentlemen or something. They just love the like British town of like skeptical, but because you hear Nick Park list them off. he's like, oh, oh, yeah, you know, the policeman's from The Invisible Man, the priest is from this movie, and you're like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, you can tell that they love British character actors and British character voices and stuff. That's just part of Aardman's deal, which is makes it this wonderful horror pastiche.
It's a little off topic, but just in case we have listeners who have never tuned into League of Gentlemen or Psychoville or any of the and I know Mark Gatiss is in this.
The old lady.
Yeah, he's so
the
good.
Old woman.
Please look those up. They are some of my favorite comedies. They are so disturbing.
Yeah, just be aware they are incredibly bleak and incredibly dark. They're tough watches. They're great, but they're tough watches. Well, that having been said, I kind of want to take us into the voice acting because often have issues, and I mean, we do this all the time now, and I, as someone who is a voice actor, full disclosure, I get really frustrated sometimes with A-list actors who they bring in to do these roles because their names will bring people in, but they can't act, right? They can't act in this medium. It's a completely different skill set that they just don't have. And so often when you see something, I will say Kubo and the Two Strings, which should have been incredible, but unfortunately the voice acting really lets that film down, which is really heartbreaking. This doesn't happen here. Here, Helena Bonham Carter is like giving it for everybody. It's Ralph Fiennes, isn't it? Who's playing
the
bad
guy?
Yeah,
he's so
fantastic in this.
I think there's some English Patient references in this because there's an airplane like Duke out and with Ralph Fiennes.
There's a little
and I
of
actually.
Everything.
Yeah, I'm just like, what animated film for children references the Anthony Minghella, Michael Ondaatje?
Well, I really love also, I think that this is not the total turning point, because I think you kind of get the idea that he always wanted to do it. But like, this is one of the first like really wacky comedies he did. And now that's kind of half of what Ralph Fiennes does, and what he's great at.
Oh, he's
because before
so great.
It's just like Made in Manhattan and the Avengers. But yeah, now we know we have like Hail Caesar and Budapest Hotel, where it's like he is great at being an incredibly broad, ridiculous comedy.
And to some extent, in Bruges. The villainy that he's able to achieve in Bruges, but also sort of, it's wonderful. You're right. That's a great point, Cam. It's here in the beginning stages, and he does it so, so well.
Victor, hadn't we agreed? No more thoughtless killing.
Quite right, my dear. So I've thought this one through very carefully. It's off to bunny heaven for you, big ears.
Victor, no!
I think you can also tell they took the freedom of like the wacky character design to be very different from themselves. And I think, Becky, if you're going to tell this good story of Helena Bonham Carter and her weird voice choices.
Totty.
Lady Tottington, if you don't mind.
Totally. Well, because I really liked listening to her interviews because she clearly comes from a place of the theater. She's very well trained. Like, she knows how to move her voice around, which is why she's really good at this. And she talked about, like, the placement of the voice wasn't quite working. Apparently, she's playing a bunch of her mother's aristocratic friends in this. But she couldn't quite get the voice right. So she's like, hold on, I have to make a phone call. Called her partner at the time, Tim Burton, who apparently just has a box of teeth sitting underneath the sink, and had him bring it over. So she threw in these fake teeth so she could get that very upper crush sort of voice going on, and it is perfection. She didn't actually do the eventual recording with the teeth, but it just gave her enough of it that it's really funny, because of course Tim Burton just has teeth lying around his house under his sink. They're poor cleaning people, the things that they must have encountered.
Yeah.
One of the things I also love about this movie is that this, and I love Wallace and Gromit period, and I think why it works for grown-ups as well as for kids, that like people often often don't do is there's a real sense of danger here. Even though, like, we're kind of in this fluffy world where, like, no one's actually going to die. You know, everything's humane. It still feels dangerous. And all of the Aardman shorts with Wallace and Gromit have that, like a close shave, the wrong trousers. Both of them, they are in, like, especially Wallace, is in just, like, immediate
danger. It tends to be a villain that wants to kill them. Which is not is always in a children's movie.
And I think, Becky, it was you, and this was really, I really loved this in season two of A Year in Film when we talked about Chicken Run. You're the one that pointed out on that episode that, like, the stakes are so high because these chickens are going to die. Not just die horribly. Their heads are going to be chopped off. They're going
to
be running
and
around.
They're listening to the other PO. They're listening to other chickens get their heads cut off. They know it's coming. It's horrible. And they're friends and they're community.
I think
it's
the
awful.
Beginning of that film, we're introduced to a character, a chicken, who dies horribly. And it was such a great point to make that it really does set, I think, Aardman animation stories apart from others. I think you get a bit in, like, Toy Story 3 when they're all contemplating. Sure.
They close their eyes and hold hands and wait for death.
No, thank you. I remember having a panic attack during that. But that is what kind of sets the Aardman apart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I think, like you talked about, that Nick Park said that, you know, they did change some of the accents and a few of the references, but he said he really confidently put his foot down because he said, you know, Jeffrey Katzenberg, you bought a quirky British movie and it's going to be British. And I think that Aardman has really stuck to their guns there. And that's maybe why some of these newer CGI ones, Shaun the Sheep, I think works great because it's silent and goofy and kids can love it. But some of the pirates, some of the other stuff is so British that I think it sometimes doesn't connect as much in North America. But that's good.
It connects in Japan, though, and it connects overseas in this big way, especially with Japan and parts of Asia. Which, you know, I'm happy we're at a point where I'm not going to say Hollywood doesn't matter or North America doesn't matter, but it doesn't matter as much because you can make so much money overseas that, like, that's really where the benchmark is. It's not how many people saw this in LA. Who cares? Like, it is.
Well, Gromit is also nonverbal.
Yeah.
And the fact that we can understand exactly what poor Gromit is always going through just by eyebrow expressions is so impressive to me, because he started out as a cat, and then when he started initially he was talking, because apparently cats are very difficult to do with all the fur, so he was like, okay, I'm gonna make him a dog, they're easier shapes. So then he became a dog, and then he had like a Scooby-Doo kind of voice and a mouth, and then he's like, well, this isn't working, and then he just started playing with the eyebrows. And, like, if you have a dog, my dog is nonverbal. She expresses herself entirely through eyes, and it's like, yeah, that's exactly what it looks like with dogs. But that we in humans can pick that up because that's the way our brains are wired is fascinating. And that you can then translate that to a plasticine figure and figure out how to communicate is, like, very
I love that Gromit rolls his eyes, like, is it 16 times? That Gromit.
Yeah, sure.
Like, this whole film is a big eye. Like, Wallace is so sweet, but just, like, this dog needs to catch a break.
And I also think the plasticine, we're gonna probably get into the debate regarding it, but I think it can be so much more expressive, partially because there is an improvisational aspect to it. And then they talk about, I mean, obviously there's some that can't be improvised. You hear a guy describe how 1 5-second shot of the transformation took them a year from conception to creating, which is insane. But I think that there is an expressiveness, and I think when we get into the next movie, the difference in how the two animation styles conceptualize expressiveness, I would go Aardman any day of the week, because I think that they stumble upon things more often. And that's why I think also you hear Nick Park say that he doesn't mind CGI, because he's like, it's models again. They're set things, and you can tweak them, but they're in space, you know? Yeah.
I think just to bring us to the end, one of the reasons I love both Wallace and Gromit and all of these is that it reminds me of my favorite genre of documentary, which is Doofus with a Dream, where, like, you're watching someone who, like, wants something really bad. So, like, the ultimate kind of expression of this is American Movie, of, like, someone who just, like, believes their dream so hard and they're making something and they're bringing everybody into their world, even though they may or may not be able to accomplish that thing. And Wallace reminds me so much of that. And I love it because apparently Wallace is based on Nick Park's dad, who was a tinkerer, which does not surprise me. And he, at one point, he made his own caravan, or like a trailer in British speak, to take to Wales, because he wanted to go to Wales. And he wallpapered the inside with the wallpaper that is on all the walls in all of Wallace's places. And I love
it's
that
iconic
so much.
Wallpaper. And that's an interesting point, because I know one of the things that really angered Nick Park while working with DreamWorks was DreamWorks was like, you know, Wallace needs like a trendier car. We don't like this. I think it's an Astra, right? An Astra van. You know, that doesn't have any referent in North America, whereas in England, you know, as a caravan, everyone knows who drives those kinds of things. So, you know, you put him in like I don't want to say he said Lamborghini, but that's what it kind of sounded like. And thank God Nick Park won out for that, because it just doesn't make sense, right? In any context, he would never be driving like a Tesla.
Yeah. Which is interesting, because like, although these are very British characters, there's definitely American archetypes of that character. I think of like almost any Jerry Lewis character is kind of sitting in that same zone, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we've always had a good job of, at least for a while, we turned all the British sitcoms into American sitcoms. Steptoe and Son is just Sanford and Son. It's the same diff.
All right. Well, when we come back, we're going to be looking at a movie that is more spooky than adventurous. It's The Corpse Bride. That's coming up after the break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The Nightmare Before Christmas changed the game in a lot of ways. Although a Touchstone picture, it's still technically Disney, so much so that the Haunted Mansion ride in Disneyland is completely redone in the Nightmare theme. That film, along with an earlier short, Vincent, established the Tim Burton animated character style. For Nightmare, the directorial reins were turned over to stop-motion master Henry Selick, and the results were a huge success. So when Tim Burton was shown the Russian folktale that was the basis for The Corpse Bride, it seemed a great way to apply his distinctive character aesthetics to another spooky project. This time, though, it wasn't Selick and Touchstone who would produce it using traditional clay stop-motion, but instead Warner Brothers and a young upstart company that would eventually become Leica, who were developing a new technique for more realism in stop-motion. Cam, do you feel like Corpse Bride was different animation-wise from anything you've seen before?
You know, I think because, weirdly, I've had to research Corpse Bride a few times, I have come to appreciate that it is different. And I actually do think, especially when you get into the Leica, mostly because most of the Leica productions now involve 3D printing, so it's actually a very different process. I think now, interestingly, it is not necessarily, we'll get into it, a style I respect, but I do think that Corpse Bride interestingly stands alone as a very relatively unique style. Where I think it maybe falters is it begins to burgeon into the, if you want it to look like this, why don't you just do CGI? Mm-hmm. To be honest, if you want it so smooth, if you want it so subtle, there's no need for it to be stop motion. But yeah, I do think it's very unique in its own way, not to my taste.
It's to my taste. I mean, I don't know if the technique is to my taste. I think I'm a defender of this film. Most people I talk to hate this. I don't think it's hateable.
Most people might include one person on this chat. No, it's not hateable. It's not hateable. I just think it's dull. I think it's also the start of kind of Tim Burton not knowing what he's doing
a bit. I can see that.
But I will also say I am a big person of, the director of this film is quite nice about Tim Burton, says Tim Burton had his fingers and everything, yada, 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 yada. Henry Selick is a lot less nice about Tim Burton, says Tim Burton showed up about five times, mm-hmm. gave him the designs on Nightmare, and it was a Henry Selick movie. But I just don't think he's that involved in these movies, to be honest. I think that they are to his vision. I think he approves everything. So I can't blame a lot of it on Tim Burton. I think he, yeah, I don't know. It's like Tim Burton presents.
I think he's spreading himself thin here, yes. too, because literally Johnny Depp is doing, and he are doing, and Helena Bonham Carter are all doing Charlie and the Chocolate Factory by day and then recording all their lines and doing the line direction by night. Like, they're doing this exact same time. That's wild.
I would love to make this a Tim Burton, a deep dive where you're like, Tim, it's very interesting that the Corpse Bride looks like your first wife, but is voiced by your second wife.
Like, Lisa Marie.
Do you want to go psychologize that? But I don't think, I don't know. Anyway, it's a unique film is what I will give it. And it's cute. The silly characters, there's enough jokes. It's worth a one watch. I just feel like compared to, also Frankenweenie coming up next is worse than this, I'd say.
Is worse?
Yeah, I think so.
No!
The original Frankenweenie is better, but Frankenweenie, the feature film?
I love Frankenweenie. I mean, you can't compare the original, which is like a live action short with Shelley Duvall, to like, I love Frankenweenie.
Okay. Well, that's for you to enjoy.
All right. Well, let's get into, because you'd mentioned that like everybody kind of attributes, and of course his name is, it's Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas, but it really is Henry Selick. And there is a particular aesthetic that's assigned to Tim Burton. And this, I actually feel it fits in that, but I also think it steps outside of that a little bit, especially when they get into like the world of the dead feels much more playful and colorful than a lot of Tim Burton stuff.
I definitely, in watching it this time, I think probably the animators of Coco, which is probably my most favorite Pixar of recent years, were definitely looking at the netherworld in this film.
I mean, I also think that, the problem is that this movie pales so hard in comparison to stuff like Coco, even The Book of the Dead. Even, like, somebody brought up Hotel Transylvania. It's like, that's kind of the same thing, where it's like a human falling into a monster world that's wacky and colorful. And you're like, those are all better than this.
There's an understated elegance to this film, though, and I think it's really rooted in the two female characters. Like, I think Emily Watson, who is voicing Victoria, and of course Helena Bonham Carter, who is the Corpse Bride, and this film is like her film. I really am drawn to those two characters and how abused they are and how suffering they are, and yet
and wafty. These are wafty
women.
It's
very Victorian. Yeah, these are, Victoria looks like the kind of woman who would die from consumption a year after being married. I don't mean to be mean, but like,
this is, I think, the only animation I've ever seen where someone is having difficulty breathing in a corset when they're, animating.
I mean, animating a woman in a corset with her, like, rib cage about to burst out is pretty remarkable. But I don't know. It's the female characters that really draw me to the story. And I guess that's really inherent in the actual folk tale, the Russian folk tale, which I don't think North Americans have any concept of this story. It doesn't really ring for us.
Speaking of the story, Cam, do you want to give us a quick plot summary on this one?
Victor Van Dort is your usual Johnny Depp Victorian fainting man who is indecisive and can't just say, he would solve this plot by just saying what's going on at any point. His parents are nouveau riche, but they have no status. They find a family who is lords and ladies, but they have no money. So they arrange this marriage between him and Victoria, played by Emily Watson. They actually kind of like each other, but Victor is such a cream puff that he can't even get the words out to get married. And while practicing his wedding speech, he accidentally drops the ring.
It's not even a wedding speech. It's just saying, with this ring, I be wed.
It's ridiculous. Like, I mean, I guess
there's something about wine and a cup. It's more complicated than
I can appreciate that if the guy yelling it at you is Christopher Lee, you might be a little nervous. But anyway, the ring lands on the finger of a corpse, a sexy corpse. and he is is then drawn to the underworld, then it becomes an issue of a corpse can't marry a living person, so if they want to be married, he will have to die, or will he have to find a way out of this corpse marriage to return to what is probably a better choice of his lady love on the surface, though the dead world is fun.
He sees his doggy. Yeah,
it's hard to tell.
His little doggy that's passed away.
Oh, that's my favorite part.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
Roll over. Roll over. Good boy, Scraps. Play dead. Sorry.
Well, that's because there's a dog and he looks like Zero from Nightmare Before Christmas, except for this is the bones as opposed to the spirit. Yes. It's very
And it definitely relates to Frankenweenie. Eventually. Yeah. I can we talk about
Tim Burton definitely had a dog that died that stuck with him to this very
there's
day.
There's a Peter Lorre worm.
Let's talk about the Peter Lorre worm. Why is it there? Why is Peter Lorre?
Why isn't
worm
he there? Like, it's just because he can be. And there is an element of that in all Tim Burton that is like gloss and frosting and kind of frustrating. But I was down with the Peter Lorre worm. Why not? It's like kind of like a Casablanca-esque bar that they're in the underworld. I think he's just, he's just the henchman.
If you ask me, your boyfriend is kind of jumpy.
Yeah. Why is Napoleon there, played by Deep Roy? It just is what it is. But yeah.
God bless Deep Roy. Again, are you busy right now, Deep Roy? No, you're just doing a movie with me right now.
Yeah, it's not like Deep Roy's playing 140 characters in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah, that's true. Deep Roy, it's like, listen, we paid you $1 million, Deep Roy. Give us one more. it's interesting. And as much as I like, I do think that those characters are quite fun. I kind of prefer, and I like you say, I think the style is a little different because I think it's quite like informed by Victorian caricature and stuff like that.
Yes.
And that's why I kind of like the people in the real world. Yeah, yeah, you're
Edward
totally right.
Edward Gorey, good call for sure.
Yeah. And but I like those, his terrible parents and the terrible parents of the other lady, you know? They're
and
fun.
The Joanna Lumley is a voice actress in this, who I will give all the She's money great. In the world to Joanna Lumley just to watch her stand there and smoke.
Well, and they've worked together before. I mean, so James and the Giant Peach is not super Tim Burton. Like, it's
no,
but
that's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
Like, so I guess they have.
But that's also where he met Mike Johnson. He worked as a lower level animator on James and the Giant Peach.
I love James and the Giant Peach.
Is that Disney?
Yeah, I think
it is
so.
Disney.
It is now. You know, it's one of those. And Mike Johnson, who is the co-director / the guy who really oversaw most of the animation, he's kind of an interesting guy because he has not done a ton. He's known mostly for, if you remember, there was a Primus did a cover of The Devil Went Down to Georgia, and he made the video for it. It's very cool, very freaky, and Tim Burton-y in a way that I think this movie isn't. But then since this film, he has not really had a project to take off, and he is now an animator at CalArts, where Tim Burton went to school. Or he's a teacher, so it's kind of interesting, because I think that this is cool, and if we want to get into the animation technique, it is a very unique and weird animation technique. I'm kind of surprised to see that this guy has not had more kicks at the can.
Well, let's talk about the technique, because we talked before about the plasticine and that you can see the thumbprints. This was, as you said, specifically designed not to see any thumbprints. So when they do normal stop motion animation, they replace the heads, or they replace the mouths or the eyes or things to kind of change the different expressions. Here, it's clockwork.
Yeah.
And the clockwork mechanism, you sort of like turn it to little degrees to get everything to move smoothly so that everything's clean. But my thing is, like, you overclick it one click and you're totally screwed. What do you do now? But it gives it, this CGI, super smooth, eerie sort of quality. Like, when people talked about when the Final Fantasy movie came out, which is one of the first, full CGI movies, people found it really uncanny valley because it's like they're not breathing and they're not blinking and it's kind of weird. And I kind of get a similar feeling to this, where it's so smooth, it does feel a little bit uncanny valley, which maybe is appropriate for this movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's not, I don't think that it doesn't work. I just think it's very interesting because that when you hear people talk about it, what they're very interested in is extreme subtlety, which is not what I look for in animation. I think sometimes it comes out quite fun. For instance, when the father character, who is played by Albert Finney, is like attempting to smile. I think something like that can probably only be achieved with this technology. But otherwise, it's weird because it's like somebody, I heard somebody compare this to like the stop motion characters had Botox, where it's like they can do stuff, but they're never doing an extreme animated.
That's a great analogy.
Move.
That's blowing my mind.
But it, like, the interesting thing is when you hear the guys, they would not be mad about this because they're like, no, we are interested in like extreme subtlety in movement, which is not what Aardman is interested in. Mm-hmm. So it's a difference, but it's like, I guess I prefer a lack of subtlety in my animation.
But it's also, I don't think this is the story to tell for that. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Because I think this is a movie that doesn't quite pick a lane. And that's why it's not like when all the reviews came out, they were like, this is too scary for kids. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like I'm shocked by it too,
because I feel like, especially compared to Nightmare or even Frankenweenie, to be honest, this is, I mean, they're dead. We're talking about death, but otherwise it's not that
scary. I
think
they're specifically referencing the fact that the guy murders the other woman.
Sure.
Voiced by Hollywood Suite favorite Richard E. Grant.
Yes.
That's right.
Great voices. Marcus. It's worth saying. Again, wonderful voices. And a lot of like hat tips to old Tim Burton collaborators. Like you say, I think this is maybe the last Michael Goff performance where he plays the old skeleton.
Yeah.
And he's delightful as always, but the Alfred the Butler from the old Batman movies.
There is a complication with your marriage.
I don't understand.
The vows are binding only until death do you part. Death has already parted you.
He is good. Yeah, that's a good character. That's a character where I felt like this animation style actually worked really well on. I think because it's not facial. He's literally just a skull with like a cracked skull with little pieces of his cranium coming off. But and a long like decaying mustache or beard. But he works really well.
I also love we mentioned Christopher Lee is in this, and Christopher Lee never phones anything in. He shows up, he knows what he's there for, to be Christopher Lee. Do we feel like this is a bone being thrown to him because he didn't end up getting to be in Sweeney Todd?
I mean, he's great
this is an
in
Albert Finney bone.
He's also in Charlie.
Yeah.
So I think that most of it is just blocking the Charlie people across the lot to do their voices.
I mean, he's so old at this point, and I know he would continue to work for a solid decade, but
sure, he put that heavy metal album in his like a year before he died.
Good for him.
I mean, I don't know, there's a lot of stuff I do respect and that is nice. This is all inspired by a story that was told by Tim Burton by Joe Ramps, who's a guy he came up with at CalArts, who then went on to Disney and
passed
did
away,
a lot
right?
of the best. The film is dedicated
to him
because he passed away that year. And it's like, that's kind of beautiful. And it's kind of wonderful to know that, because I think sometimes you're like, oh, this is Tim Burton really farting something out. But this is a story he was told as a young man that stuck with him. And he obviously was like wanting to find a way to tell this story for a long time.
I don't think it has all the attention that he would put into it. And that,
only
thing.
I think that he's spread thin. If you think about somebody, I mean, both of these, and this film especially, I think can be compared quite a bit to what will be upcoming, which is Wes Anderson's dip into stop motion. He also uses puppets from McKinnon and Saunders, which is what these guys use. But the difference with Wes Anderson is he loves the fur, and he's like, and when they were like,
the velvet,
but Wes, when we touch the fur, you're going to see it. And he's like, yeah, I want that, baby. And it's like, that's, I think, I like that a little more.
It's an interesting comparison, too, because especially on Fantastic Mr. Fox, which, no surprises, is beloved by me, similar accusations were made against him that he barely showed up to set, that he was there for 5 days.
I thought he kind of took time off for that one, but no, he was also just floating.
I think if you Google it, there's some associate producers or even the head of animation of Fantastic Mr. Fox who was bold enough to call him out, I think, in Vanity Fair. Yeah. I think that has changed with Isle of Dogs. I think he was very involved. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's an interesting kind of atelier workshop scenario with these stop motion auteurs like Burton and Wes Anderson, where it's almost like a, you know, Caravaggio or like Rembrandt, where we're not sure who's the actual artist,
and
but
I
we sign Rembrandt's name because, you know, who knows?
Oh, yeah. I will say that it is worth pointing out that I think probably the big problem with that Wes Anderson one is he's the sole credited director.
Yeah.
So to pull that and be the sole credited director is a whole next level.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's, I mean, it's also like, what are you going to do? To dedicate yourself to stop motion, you have to be Nick Park and you have to be doing it 24/7. And if you're not that kind of filmmaker, you're not. But it's kind of disappointing when Tim Burton, whose background is animation, when you hear that about him, it's that sounds like he doesn't have his whole heart in the project. And another person I will say does not have their whole heart in the project. I'll call you out, Danny Elfman. These songs are boring. Mm-hmm. And I think even compared to Charlie, at least he's going wild and experimenting.
He's probably really tired.
But I think that's the problem, because he's transporting everybody over from one to the other. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody had time. Like, even Johnny Depp talks about, he's like, he was just coming off of set playing Willy Wonka, which was a super challenging character for him to play. He's like, hey, do you want to go next door and we'll record a bunch of stuff for Corpse Bride? And he's like, I haven't even looked at the script. I don't really have the character. He's like, it's fine. You'll come up with it as you go along.
Yeah.
You know, it's that kind of stuff of like, no, he's an actor. He wants to prepare. Let him kind of, create
some
a character.
Ways this feels like a workhorse experiment for Burton, where he knows that he's going to start to do more stop motion with Frank and Weenie, and so like, let's do a test. Let's have a point in my career where I have two films that year, so I'm guaranteed to have at least one be a success, and the other can just be an experimental ground, if that makes sense.
Mm. Sure. And I do think
people still loved this movie.
I like this movie.
Ebert thought it was beautiful.
It did okay. It's not a massive flop. I think they wanted more out of it. And I would say, Alicia, to the credit of Frank and Weenie, I feel like Frank and Weenie feels much more like a Tim Burton film.
Absolutely.
You know? And has much more, like, even his visual style. Not that I don't hate this one for straying a bit, but that one does a bit seem more like his drawings come to
life.
Have
you watched Frank and Weenie recently, or did you just watch it once?
I don't like it. No, I don't know.
Becky, what about
you? I guess I just don't like something that's so referential.
I haven't seen that one. That's actually I will put it on my list. I will watch it. I will weigh
it. That turns into a bat, which I love.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like a fun Godzilla thing. If you like the references in Curse of the Were-Rabbit, it's like a
very
more fun version of that.
Shelley the turtle, I love them.
The other thing I do like about Corpse Bride, which I saw somebody bring up, and is a great point, and I think Alicia can talk to with her work with TIFF and Tim Burton stuff, is that it was a chance for him to make up for the fact that he had worked with McKinnon and Saunders on those tests for Mars Attacks, because Mars Attacks was meant to be a stop motion animation thing.
That's true.
And if you've ever seen those tests, they are immaculate.
Yeah.
And you immediately get, not that I love Mars Attacks, and I actually think the CGI in Mars Attacks is wonderful and very tactile, but man, oh man, do I wish it was the stop motion little aliens, because they were a delight.
Yeah, Mars Attacks is one of my favorite Tim Burton's. It's up there. It's probably in the top three. Oddly enough, of all the TIFF exhibitions, the only two I didn't work on are Tim Burton.
Because
it was before my time. That was 2010 that opened Lightbox. I didn't start working for them until 2012. Mm. And Fellini, which no one remembers, so it doesn't matter.
No.
The Burton I saw at MoMA. I was actually not living in Toronto in 2010. So I'm familiar with the exhibition, which was, I think, four times the size of what TIFF did.
Yes.
I remember seeing some of those exact figures you're talking about that were made by that company for Mars Attacks on display, which I don't believe made it to Toronto, but could have.
Oh, there was the figures, little animation test.
The last thing I want to kind of bring us into is I do appreciate they continue on with the grand tradition of puns, in that Harryhausen is obviously an influence for everybody who has done stop motion, pioneer, trailblazer. And so here you have both dancing skeletons and the name on the piano. It's a Harryhausen piano.
Cute.
And I'm like, thank you very much. All right. Well, that should bring us to the end of this episode. Alicia Fletcher, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you once again for bringing more animation, because, man, I love this stuff. It's so great.
Yeah, it's really fun to talk about animation with the three of you. Wait.
Yeah. There's just two of us. Hold on.
I mean, I can bring out a little robot or something.
No, there's a little worm that looks like Peter Lorre on Becky's shoulder.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
it. I've named him Claude. Demand retribution. That Cam, I want. Oh, I guess you said you did watch it. Okay.
I don't want to watch it again. Listen, I'm in the middle of watching Henry Selick's Monkey Bone because I was like, isn't Monkey Bone kind of like Corpse Bride? It is.
It is very. That's a very good point.
And also, I remember liking parts of Monkey Bone.
I don't think it's a good movie, but I think something like the performance of Chris Kattan as an animated corpse, delightful.
Would you recommend a rewatch?
I mean, I'm only 15 minutes in.
But a soft recommend.
Yeah. If you've got Disney Plus, shockingly, Monkey Bone is on it. So, go nuts.
Okay, and you know what? I will watch just about anything Dave Foley is in because Dave Foley, seriously underrated character actor. I can't wait till we get to talk about him next season. Cameron Maitland, thank you so much for being
with us. Yeah, thank you. And like I say, check out Primus's The Devil Went Down to Georgia video for some fun animation by Mike Johnson.
All right. And you can join us next week with very special guest Adam Naiman as we go to the dark side. We're looking at two takes on the neo-noir genre. That's Brick and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang coming up next week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen. On 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland. And today featured Alicia Fletcher and Cameron Maitland as guests. Supervising producer is Emily Gagné. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Camaria. Creative consultant was Ryan Mains. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.